Giles Brown.
Let's talk.
We can work it out. We can work it out.
We can work it out by the Beatles. Well, could they work it out? We may fall apart before too long, goes the song lyric. Well, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, Blur, Bowie, Kate Bush and Coldplay were all signed to EMI. It was one of the big four record companies with some of the biggest names in the history of recorded music on its books. It'd been going for more than 100 years. And then, in a series of unprecedented events, EMI basically fell apart. It's the subject of a new book, a great new book called The Final Days of EMI. It's by Eamon Ford. Joining me live on the line from the UK is Eamon Ford himself. Eamon, good morning to you.
Hi there, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad for a Monday morning, thanks for asking. EMI, one of the big four radio record companies, had signed artists like the Beatles and the Beach Boys in the early days. How had it got to this position of, because when it was by like 1970s, it was master of basically all it surveyed. So what happened
was the entire record industry went into freefall around the turn of the millennium. The impact of digital was something that they were partly ready for, but partly not. Napster came along. It basically made music free. And then there was a huge knock-on effect as these companies that had traditionally sold physical products, so LPs and CDs, suddenly were forced to get their heads around digital much quicker than they thought they were going to have to. So record sales went into free fall. The whole market contracted. It was very difficult to kind of make money. And EMI was the smallest of the major record companies at that point. So it was obviously kind of in the weakest position. So then in 2007, a private equity company called Terra Firma came along and they paid $4.2 billion for the company. So it's recorded music interest and its music publishing an interest, and they were going to look to rebuild it as a very forward thinking digital music company. But that purchase also coincided with the collapse of the global economy. So it was almost like if you'd scripted the absolute worst time to buy a record company, I would have said it would have been May 2007, which was when Terra Firma bought EMI.
I mean, we talk about EMI having several large rock bands on its books, and you know there was this thing about sort of the rock dinosaurs who weren't ready for punk and new wave in the late 70s, etc. I mean, yeah. EMI was a rock dinosaur of the music business.
Well, to an extent, there is a bit of a narrative that the entire music industry was fast asleep. EMI was experimenting, it was doing some things with digital, but basically nobody foresaw that a company like Napster could come along and effectively just go, here's the entire history of recorded music for free. So it's almost like a gun was put to the record industry's head, also at the same time as the floor kind of fell from under them. So the circumstances were, let's be euphemistic about it and say, the circumstances were not ideal. But everyone was in the same boat. All of the big record companies, even a lot of the independent record companies, they were suddenly going, okay, the rules have completely changed. We can either try and litigate our way out of this, or we can actually try and rebuild the company. And all sectors are going through that. The newspaper industry, magazine industry, the film industry, TV industry, radio industry, they've all been kind of turned upside down by digital. It just happened that music was the first one to really go through the ringer.
And tell me a little bit more about sort of Terra Firma then. How did they, I mean, did they have any background in music, or were they just literally coming in to try and revamp a business?
They had no background in music. Their kind of approach was to identify an ailing business, spend 7 years kind of stripping it back, rebuilding it, refocusing it. And they kind of come off two big successes. They had turned around a German service station chain called Tank and Rest, and they were in the middle of turning around the Odeon chain in the UK. So they were coming with a track record of turning around businesses that were struggling. But the problem is that the music industry is an incredibly complex business. It's not just fixing the toilets in a service station chain as they did in Germany. You're dealing with artists who are, by their very nature, are mercurial. They don't necessarily deliver albums when you would like them for your financial year, because it's a creative process. You also sign lots of artists and only a handful of them make money. A very famous figure quoted around that time was only 10% of artists on a major record company would actually turn a profit. So 90%, it's an industry predicated on failure. So this was a very, very hard learning curve for Terra Firma. They knew how to restructure companies, but they were in the art, they were in the kind of creative business now, and that doesn't necessarily adhere to the cold hard logic of finance and markets.
Yeah, the anything to do with media, the arts, creativity, so it doesn't tend to go down normal business patterns, does it? Also the thing was, I mean, EMI, I said it was, you know, if you like, it was known as for people like, you know, like the Beatles, like Bowie, like the Beach Boys. There was a new, as well as the downloads going on and people going, what, you know, this, because I think it was a sea change that people didn't want physical product in their hand anymore and didn't want to buy albums. But also the sort of music that the EMI was traditionally best known for wasn't going into the new millennium with, you know, ED, electronic dance music, with rap. I mean, these weren't the artists that EMI had been signing either.
Well, the problem was that EMI historically had always been really weak in America. This was a big problem. It was strong in Europe in terms of finding new talent and exporting that to the world. So obviously the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Pet Shop Boys, Radiohead, Coldplay, it could export British artists, but it always really struggled to sign American artists. And that's the kind of the key ingredient here, because if you want to be a global company, you have to be able to kind of punch above your weight in the biggest market in the world, which was America. And that was always where EMI was weakest, so that kind of left it quite exposed. So it definitely, EMI's approach was to take kind of sort of maverick artists or outsider artists and help them get across the mainstream. And traditionally, those were British artists, but its talent pool was not coming from America. And obviously, it was missing out on the change in kind of consumer behavior, the kind of the rise of rap from the 80s onwards. EMI was not really a competitor. EDM was kind of bubbling under a little bit. And as things kind of progressed, it managed to sign artists like David Guetta, Swedish House Mafia, Deadmau5. So in its kind of dying days, it was getting its head around kind of EDM. But yeah, kind of being weak in America was just, I think it, for the long term, it was probably death by a million cuts.
Mm. And you also say that, I mean, despite Terra Firma having sort of a good background in other companies it's taken over, you reckon it probably overpaid by about £1 billion.
Well, they reckon they overpaid by £1 billion because due to regulatory issues, they couldn't merge with another music company. So someone from outside of the music industry had to come in. And because EMI was a publicly listed company, you had to offer a particular price per share. So Terra Firma, because they knew that other people were bidding, were offering $2.65 a share. As it turns out, in the last days of the bidding before the deadline closed, Terra Firma were actually the last one standing. Now, they were borrowing $2.6 billion off the $4.2 billion they paid for EMI from Citigroup. And Citigroup was also operating on the sales side of EMI, and there were two big court cases where Terra Firma was accusing Citigroup of perhaps misleading them to make them overpay for EMI. Citigroup was cleared in the first case in New York of any of that, and then a second case in London was abandoned a couple of days in. But if Terra Firma argued that if they knew that they were the last bidder, they wouldn't have bid $2.65 a share. They would have bid somewhat lower than that, and they possibly say they could have got it for maybe just over $3 billion instead of $4 billion. And ultimately, at the end, because the huge debt on Terra Firma to kind of meet the debt repayments on that $2.6 billion loan, that was really what did for them, because in the final year, they were actually starting to turn the company around. They were doing really good things. They were doing interesting and quite innovative things for that period, which are now kind of standard practice in the record industry. But they just ran out of road. So going back to my earlier point about just being a story of incredibly bad time, and they also just ran out of time.
Also, they did. I mean, what were the reactions of some of the big artists who were on EMI's books? I mean, a lot of them sort of. I mean, it's difficult to deal with these artists, as we said before. Some of them just simply walked away.
Yeah, well, lots of them did. Radiohead famously had did in Rainbows just as Terra Firma came in, which they let people pay whatever they wanted for online, and they kind of walked away from a renegotiation. The Rolling Stones took their kind of post-1971 catalogue with them. Paul McCartney left, Queen left. So a lot of the kind of the marquee artists, the artists who'd really built up EMI as a global company, started to walk away. At the same time, EMI was really, really struggling to sign new artists because managers and artists were going, well, are you, you've been bought over by this company? Are you going to be around in a couple of years? Will we go to one of the other major record companies? So EMI was really, for a couple of years, was bleeding from both ends. It was losing some of its biggest artists, and it was really, really struggling to kind of find the superstars of tomorrow.
How did you, why did you decide that this was the time to write a book like this? And who did you speak to in the, you know, because it's always interesting and people maybe don't want to speak about failures more than they do great successes. So who did you...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it kind of, I decided to write it because it kind of had a full stop. Terra Firma took CD Group to court twice, once in New York and then a few years later in London. And part of their walking away from the court case in London was that was the end of it. All the litigation was over. So the story had a clear start and a clear end. So I thought, okay, I can start to tell this. And there was enough distance, I think, from all those involved that it wasn't as kind of emotional. So lots of people, EMI, who may have lost their jobs, weren't quite as kind of caught up in the emotion of it. Terra Firma, who obviously lost a lot of money and a lot of standing in the city, also were able, I guess, to be a bit more philosophical, a bit more distant. Things weren't quite so raw. So I basically... I spoke to everyone I could. Obviously, there's lots of people in the book who are quoted anonymously because they're still working in and around the industry, and they may have, for legal reasons, can't go on public. But I basically spoke to kind of a lot of the key players at EMI, a lot of the key players at Terra Firma, including Guy Hans, who was the head of Terra Firma. So I spent 2 days interviewing him right at the end of the process, because I think ultimately I spoke to probably... I think I did something like 70 formal interviews and then about 30 kind of informal chats. So pretty much everyone, with the exception of Citigroup, who were the lender of this $2.6 billion, they refused to speak to me. And there were one or two executives here or there who spoke to me. But I would say I certainly spoke to pretty much all of the key players.
How willing then was, I mean, you spent 2 days with Guy Hans. I mean, it was his group. This was a huge blow for his, for Terra Firma. I mean, it's great that you actually were able to speak with him, because other business leaders might not want to speak freely about, you know, a corporate disaster.
Yeah, well, to his credit, obviously, there was a narrative, and I wanted to kind of tell the full story. There was a narrative that a guy who comes in from private equity massively misunderstands the music industry. He pratfalls, isn't it hilarious that this multimillionaire messed up a deal? But I thought there was a lot more complexity going on. I think that perhaps they started badly, but they were doing interesting things. And I also just wanted to kind of understand what was going on. And I met him very early on and said, I want to speak to you. And I guess his feeling was that because this reductive narrative around what had happened was kind of starting to ossify into fact, he felt that it was better that he speak to me and get people that he'd brought in to speak to me, so at least their side of the story was being presented. And obviously, it's a long book. I think it's like 160,000 words, something like that. So I was able to go into a lot of detail and speak to lots and lots of different people. So I suppose maybe his thinking was that at least if he speaks to me, at least his viewpoint is put across into the wider thing. So and like, I didn't want to go in there and do a stitch up on either side. I genuinely also myself just wanted to learn about what happened. So that's why I spoke to as many different people on all sides.
Do you think, I mean, did you get to speak to any of the artists themselves off the record and you know, anybody who'd walked away giving their reasons for... Because EMI had obviously, you know, nurtured their careers and you know, at the peak of it being one of the big, if not... I mean, I'm a rock fan. I mean, EMI is embedded in my vinyl library.
Yeah. I started off thinking, okay, I'd be really interested to speak to some of the artists. And then I started to speak to some of their managers and they would go, and the managers were all going, well, they're not really involved in the business side of things. They would have opinions, but if you want to understand the whole machination of the business and the industry, it's the managers who are the guys who are doing the deals. And obviously, they were also slightly outside of EMI. So I spoke to artist managers because I think it was very much a business story. And the artists obviously will be very interested in the types of deals that they're getting and the money that they're earning from their record deals or whatever, but they wouldn't really understand the kind of the day-to-day of of a business restructuring because they're so far removed from it. Their managers would be the people to speak to. So I spoke to a lot of managers, some of them off the record, But Tim Clark, who manages Robbie Williams, obviously one of the biggest artists on EMI Space, spoke to me as well. So there are managers because, yeah, they're ultimately the business representatives of the artists. So, yeah, I could have spoken to artists, but I thought that would have taken the book in a slightly different direction. There probably is another book about what was the cultural impact of the collapse of EMI. Mine is more about what is the business impact of the collapse of EMI.
So what was the business impact and what lessons did you think it had? I mean, we talked about a change because nobody could have seen the way that digital music and downloads and the fact that people don't buy albums anymore, really. Yeah. They just buy singles. And they don't buy physical products if they can get it on their, you know, on their tablets and their phones. What lessons do you think that the industry could learn, has learned, and should have learned about what happened with EMI?
There's lots and lots of lessons there. I think the lesson to learn is to not buy a company quickly and to try and change it immediately, which I think obviously Terra Firma was under huge pressure to do that. There was one executive that Terra Firma brought in, a guy called David Kassler, because lots of the Terra Firma people who were brought in, the EMI staff took against them immediately because these were outsiders telling them how to do their jobs. It's like, don't tell your teacher granny how to suck eggs. But a guy brought in called David Kassler was kind of universally liked by everyone within EMI. And he said a very interesting thing when I spoke to him. He had turned around lots of businesses for Terra Firma, and he said that what he does, any new company he comes into, he spends the first six months at the back just listening, and then he starts to formulate a plan. But because Terra Firma had taken out this enormous debt, they just had to go in pell mell and try and do things. So they kind of the clock was ticking against them. So I suppose the issue is kind of take your time, spend the first 6 months just understanding things, and then formulate a plan. Just don't run in kind of and try and change things immediately. You're trying to turn around a long-established business that is very good at many things, but is also being challenged in other areas. And you need to kind of take, and it was kind of a moving target as well. You need to really understand what was going on there. So again, going back to the timing issue, I think this is the kind of recurring motif in the book, is for if you're going to take over a company, take your time, understand what you bought into, understand the complexities of that. I don't think Terra Firma really understood how to deal with artists at the start, because as someone said, if you're dealing with products like baked beans or soft drinks or something, it's just physical product into shop. But in art and in music, the product is the artist in a way, but the product can talk back. And that was a big, big thing that Terra Firma learned. So obviously lots of artists walking away, being critical of them in the press. And the thing that you should learn in the music industry is even if the artist is absolutely in the wrong, never have a public war with them, because the public sympathy will always be with the artist, and it will never be with the corporate behemoth. So there was a lot of that in the first kind of year as well, a lot of quotes that were kind of used against Terra Firma, because it kind of was clear that they didn't understand how artists work. They weren't able to speak the language of artists. They were very much able to speak the language of business and restructuring, but the great executives in music history, so you could have people like Zach Holzman from Elektra, or Seymour Stein from Sire, or Barry Gordy from Motown, were able to talk business and art at the same time and speak them both equally well. Terra Firma were very good at speaking business. They weren't very good at speaking art.
The book is called The Final Days of EMI, Selling the Pig. Why is it called Selling the Pig, by the way?
A long, long story tied to the sale of EMI. It was basically Citigroup believed that EMI was a bad company to buy, or certainly that was Terra Firma's argument. So in the court case, they found, in the deposition, they found an email from one person at Citigroup to another when the deal went through to Terra Firma, and they went, congratulations, I see you finally sold the pig. So they used to refer to EMI as the pig. That's how little they thought of EMI at the time.
Brilliant. The book is called The Final Days of EMI, Selling the Pig. It's by Eamon Ford. It's out now with Omnibus. Eamon, if people want to find out more about you, is there a website? Can they contact you on social media? How can they find out where you are?
I don't have a website. I just live on social media, and it will be a very disappointing experience if you want to follow me on social media, but it's Eamon_Ford if you want to find me on Twitter or Instagram.
Marvellous. Only begs the question, after selling the pig, what's the next one in your sights?
Oh, that's a very good question. I can't quite say. I'm going to speak to the publishers about a second book. That will happen. It will be music business related. I don't think it will be a story quite as spectacular as this one, because there's a lot happening in this story. I think I'll probably have a much calmer story to tell the next time.
Eamon Ford, author of The Final Days of EMI, Selling the Pig. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Talk Radio Europe.